All right, welcome to the Retro Game Club podcast, season 3, episode 17, which is also episode 89. I am Rob, and also someone looking through his retro stuff to see what he could put some gasoline in, Hugh.
Yeah, that's right. Every empty box container I have here, I bring my Sega CD clamshells and just filling them with gas. You know, I couldn't get in on like the PS5 hoarding or the Switch hoarding or the NES Classic hoarding or the Super Nintendo Classic hoarding. So I figure this is one I can get in on because we don't have gas shortages in the Midwest.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. So how's that working out?
It smells terrible.
Just hold. Maybe the gas prices will go up and you could sell when they're high.
Yeah. Yeah. For sale. Sonic the Hedgehog clamshell filled with gas.
That is great. Yeah. So what's been going on?
So in the nighttime, I've been playing Shakedown Hawaii. I think maybe I said in the last episode I was going to start that. I don't remember now. So it's by the developer of Retro City Rampage, and it's really good. I was expecting to say that I'm really early on in the game, but I'm probably pretty far because I've been playing it, you know, an hour or two in the night. Really addictive. I mean, it's a little bit like Retro City Rampage. I mean, it's very similar. The graphic style and the combat style remind me of a game that I will talk about later in the episode. But then it has like this whole like business management thing going on. It's a little bit like, have you played Vice City Stories, the sequel to Vice City?
Yeah, but not since it came out, really.
Okay, I would compare it sort of like that, where it's still fundamentally like an open world game, but you also buy businesses to earn extra money.
Okay.
So I've had a lot of fun with that. We were just talking about the crazy gas hoarding thing that I guess people are doing. It reminded me, because this is definitely retro gaming adjacent, about how, did you see how Target and Walmart are not going to sell Pokemon trading cards anymore?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's dangerous.
Yeah. Yeah. But that to me is like, that's exactly like, that signify, I don't know, it's like an example of where our culture is at right now, along with the gas hoarding. You know, like, hey, gas supply is going to be low for 5 whole days. How about if you don't need to buy gas, you don't? So then people fill trash bags with gas.
Yes.
That's a good idea. I mean, I get it. Like, if you ran a landscaping business, go ahead and take all your empty canisters and fill them. Like, that's fine. But if you're just, like, at home on social media or watching Judge Judy all day or something, don't go to the gas station and fill your trash bags with gas.
And also, you could still work from home anyway, usually. So,
right, depends. I mean, depends. I know for a lot of people, it's not an option.
Yeah, yeah.
But certainly, if working from home is an option for you, and the news says gas supplies are going to be low for 5 days, use that as an opportunity to not buy gas for 5 days. If you were,
yes.
Like, that's the way I view it. It just has a real, just two more side notes. So, I ordered the Castlevania Collection from Limited Run Games, even though I own all of them already.
But which one did you get?
The Switch one. I figure I'm most likely to play Castlevania games on the Switch. Now, they're probably all on the Nintendo service, I bet.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they're not all on there, but some of them probably are. And I usually play these games in October. You know, it's like a Halloween tradition for me to play a Castlevania game. So.
Oh, yeah.
So if there's like 5 or 6 games on there, it will last me 5 or 6 years.
Yeah, yeah. I think a few have been our Game Club games, too. Kid Dracula, yeah. And stuff like that.
Kid Dracula, Super Castlevania was. Mm-hmm. And then, it seems weird, but I was, you know, you'll find out later on when I make a Game Club pick. But it seems like my picks are, have like a theme of like summer break in the arcade. Like, I don't know if you ever spent a summer break where you went to the arcade a lot. You
probably did. Oh, yeah.
And I think there's some mental thing going on with me where it's like a overreaction to like a year of lockdown and no Midwest Gaming Classic that I'm just like craving being in, you know, around arcade games. So I think I will probably keep that going for a while.
Good. I'm sure people are enjoying it. I hope they are.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah. Yeah. What about you? What have you been up to?
Let's really not too much to... that I've been up to, still playing the same games I've been playing. This is going to be a weird episode because we have a very long interview that we'll talk about in a minute. We're going to skip the news this time. So probably our next episode will have lots of news. But
yes.
We have a long interview. We didn't want to have a crazy long episode. But and also, we're inching closer to episode 100. We're going to kind of announce this in advance that episode 100 will be a Ask Us Anything in Reason episode. So please, email us, specific questions that we will probably answer. We'll read them all on episode 100. Keep writing us, your regular emails, but Ask Us Anything. I'll save all those emails. And there might be a giveaway. I'm going through my stuff, and I have some cool things that are barely used that I think a lot of our listeners will like. So we have about 10 episodes until then, which is like 10 to 12 weeks. Yeah, so you all have time. So please.
Hey, what's the email address if they want to do this?
Email@retrogameclub.net. Now, for this kind of stuff, you will have to email us if there's a giveaway. We prefer these kind of questions in email. But I'm sure if you ask them online, Zach will curate them as well. Mm-hmm. It's just, for us, harder to get a hold of you for that stuff. But more details to come. And other than that, I guess we go straight to our topic, right?
Yeah.
I guess. It's kind of weird. But we had a second interview in a row that... scheduling for Hugh. I'm sorry, Hugh. It just didn't work out.
Well, actually, last week it turned out was even worse for work than I thought. So I was online later than I expected basically every night last week. And then I went straight onto the PlayStation to decompress.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry to hear that. That does not sound fun.
No, this week's going to be pretty tame, I hope. So.
Well, you just jinxed it.
Yeah. Yeah, probably. Watch the production go down or something.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, so I was able to interview an old friend and colleague, BK Taylor. A quick introduction of him. He started at National Lampoon, the magazine, doing comic strips for them. He just released a book called I Think He's Crazy that you could get on Amazon and other places of all those cartoons. He went on to work on Eureka's Castle. What was it called? Hot Fudge, Super Fudge, something like that. I think it was a local show on in Detroit. But if you remember in Home Improvement, Tim Allen's name in it is Tim the Tool Guy Taylor because of BK Taylor. He was one of the head writers, I think head writers, on Home Improvement. And he also worked on the Muppets, created some Muppets characters and... And before we get started, BK did email me that he thinks he did get a few of these dates wrong, specifically the Muppets ones. So if I forget to edit anything out, there's a little asterisk there that dates may be off. And here you go. All right, we have BK Taylor with us, my old colleague and friend. Welcome to the show, BK.
Well, thank you, Rob. Good hearing from you again.
Absolutely, yeah. You made it through the apocalypse, apparently, of 2020.
That was kind of my life anyway.
And you decided to release a book during it.
Yeah. At the peak of a pandemic, R.L. Stine, who. The Goosebumps author. Mm-hmm. He was an editor at Scholastic and was my boss at one time. And we became friends because of our phone conversations and so forth. And we go visit him every year. But he wrote over and said, "Only you would bring out a book at the peak of a pandemic."
A comedy book while no one's laughing.
Yeah. And man, nobody is laughing today. No one. Seinfeld gave up going on the road because nobody's laughing. People were jeering and catcalling. So he gave it up. How many comedies do you see being released right now, in film?
Well, I'm glad you're keeping it going.
I'm keeping it going.
Keep it alive.
I'm holding up the banner. Come on, let's laugh.
So tell us about the book. It's all your original work from your days at National Lampoon's, right?
Yes, yeah, which was quite a span, I found out as I started putting things together. It was really almost, I think it was like 14 years I was submitting. And then I started on Home Improvement, but anyway, we'll get to that. Mm-hmm. It was fun. It was when, God, it was another world. It was, you couldn't publish The Lampoon today. Just too many people being very sensitive, and you just couldn't do it. But back then, they would actually call and say, come on, push the envelope, man. You know, take it further. They were, for a while, they were just saying, you know, what are you, Walt Disney?
To your comic strip specifically, right?
Yes, yeah. I did some loose illustrations throughout the years in one pagers on a whole different subject, but the book is made up of the three cartoon strips, the Appletons and Timberland Tales and Uncle Kunta, mm-hmm. which is dangerous territory, I suppose, but I have never received a negative letter or email or anything. It's been great. It's been well received, and I'm very happy with it. Fantagraphics did a really nice job putting it together. The art director was
good. When someone describes each of those three comic strips, each of them could sound wildly offensive, but when you read them, mm-hmm. there's really, I think from any way you look at it, there's really nothing offensive in any of them. Like you said, they kept asking you to go further, and that's just not in your nature, you know?
No, it just wasn't. And I'm glad you feel that way, because particularly the Appletons, who was created really to make fun of the perfect sitcom families of the 60s and 70s, where, you know, the Brady Bunch and so forth. And we decided to, I actually came up with the idea. I worked on it for a while. I was a fan of the Lampoon before I got in there. Mm-hmm. And there were so many great writers that were working. And then when I was in New York, I stopped by the office, and the receptionist said that someone will be out to meet you. And it was Doug Kenny, one of the creators of the National Lampoon, who was actually from Harvard, where the Harvard Lampoon was. And he came out, and he had a civil defense helmet on, from the war years.
Yeah.
They used to wear these white helmets with a CD on it, civil defense. And he stood there, and I thought, I was very uneasy. I was nervous because I thought, you know, he's setting me up, and I'm not going to fall into a trap. I'm not going to ask him why he has a helmet on. And so I stood there, and he looked at my work, and very straight, didn't say a thing about it. And like, you know, excuse me, I got this helmet on because we're doing a shoot or something. But he said, why don't you go take your work back to Sean Kelly and Brian McConaughey. And I expected at any minute he would say something. And to this day, I don't know why he had that helmet on. So he got me. But that's, they had this book, the very large National Lampoon comics book. And both the editors really thought it would be perfect for that. And they said, draw in a 50s style if you can. Hmm. And I said, sure, sure. And then I thought, geez, what is that? and so I came home and started looking at 50s things. And my dad was an artist, so he actually had, you know, these perfect families and so forth that he had illustrated. Wow. He actually did some covers for Motown and so forth. And was really a good artist. But I kind of used that capital. My first strips were pretty bad because I didn't know where I was going, you know, illustrated-wise.
And these comic strips at National Lampoon, the three of them, that's how you met Tim Allen for the first time, right?
Yeah, he was a big fan of the Appletons. He and I finally met through a friend at a comedy club. This Bob Melnicki was his name, and he was friends with Tim. And he said, "You two should get together." And so I met him at the comedy club and watched his act, and I thought, "Wow, he's funny." And
was that at Ridley's?
Ridley's? Uh-huh, yeah. Ridley's Comedy Castle.
Great place.
And we met after the show, and we kind of realized we had the same sense of humor. And then when he found out that I had done the Appletons for the Lampoon, he always thought I was in New York. And in reality, we were really living a stone's throw from each other.
Yeah.
And we became pals, and when he had the offer, he said, "Why don't you try out?" You know, and wow, that was a big step for me, because you know when you're doing a cartoon strip, full page or whatever, even three or four pages, it's totally different. Those are vignettes, whereas when you write an entire script, you know, have to do acts and you have to have arcs in your writing and so forth. And so it was really a baptism by fire.
So and, was his name Tim Taylor because you're BK Taylor?
That's the rumor. Yeah. that's kind of the rumor. And he wanted to be Norm Appleton. He wanted me to write a script and do a film of the Appletons. In fact, the show itself, Tim was offered Katzenberg and Eisner. Michael Eisner, who were the head of Disney at the time, and they had seen Tim in a comedy club in Los Angeles, and they thought, oh man, he's got all that we need for a sitcom. He's got the look, he's got everything, he knows comedy. And so they offered him a show. And I think the first one, as I remember, it was like a detective with a canine dog, which you go, ooh. And Tim actually turned them down. And that was like, what?
Yeah, I mean, that ended up being like a John Belushi movie, right? That canine movie?
Yeah. I think it did. Yeah, it did. But you just don't turn down those two guys. That was like, you can't do that. And then they came up with something else, I think another detective thing or whatever. But then it was thought of in... for a brief moment in time, it was actually the Appletons.
Mm, wow.
And I got this new agent, and all this was coming so fast, my head was spinning. And then, as quickly as it came, it disappeared. And then Walt Disney said, "Why are we giving this guy?"
That's showbiz, right?
Yeah. So anyway, I tried out. It's like submarine duty, because when you write for these shows, particularly the first two seasons, the first producers were slow in developing what they thought we should get so we could be there till 2 o'clock in the morning. Writing, and you're in a box, basically. So it's almost like submarine. You know? You better be able to get along or...
Sir, what day is today? You know, what day is it?
We've all got these beards and, and no oxygen. It was tough at first. And also, one of the producers introduced me to the rest of the writing staff as a friend of Tim Allen's.
Oh, man.
A good friend of Tim Allen's, which is like putting the branding the scarlet letter on your
Yep. Look out for this Yahoo. Yeah. He thinks he's the prince of this show.
Oh, my God. I remember walking in. I'm nervous enough already and walking into the writing area. It was on the Disney lot. That's where we wrote. And seeing some of the writers talking, and then somebody glancing over, and then them dispersing before I got there. It was like, oh no, I'm that kid. And so, like the first part of my relationship with the writers was very cautious. They didn't want to say too much.
No, guys, I barely know the guy. I barely know him.
Yeah. I don't trust him. He looks evil. Because the writers, if a gag falls flat, the writers will blame the actors, and the actors will blame the writers. Uh-huh. So no one wanted this information passed on to Tim. And my first script was around Christmas time. It was this camping episode, which I was given. I had come up with other writers. You have this idea room where you have these little cards on the board, and they're ideas, snippets, A, B, and C stories. Mm. In other words, the main story, and then a secondary story, maybe with the kids. Third story with somebody else in the cast. And I'd come up with this camping episode. It was at Christmas time. And so they handed it to me, and everybody was going to Hawaii and blah, blah, blah. But no one was going to be around, and I had to go back to Michigan to write this. And I'm going, geez, they're just going to leave me alone? And so I came back and I started in, but I had questions, and I'd try and reach someone, and I couldn't get a hold of anyone. But anyway, I came back with this script, and it was really fat. In other words, over budget.
Oh.
And when I handed it in, they all read it. And said, oh, we got to do some rewriting. The people, like some of the people, the bean counters, would pass me in the hall when I first got there, saying, "Hi, how are you?" And then after this blown up budget show, they would just kind of walk by. It was so blown out. I can't believe what a nightmare that was. I remember walking to the first rehearsal and being by myself. The other writers were in a clump ahead of me. Nobody wanted to see the guy go down. I even saw a little piece of sagebrush kind of blow in front of me.
Yeah.
I thought, I'm the loneliest guy in the world.
Yeah.
And we got through the rehearsal and so forth, but they realized that this thing is going to be huge. They had to, for the first time, use two stages. two sound stages. And that is deadly since, you know, they have comedians. Billy Rebeck was the comedian who kept the audience on fire, kept them laughing through retakes and so forth, because you have to keep that energy up. Mm-hmm. And so they had they had the one stage where all the sets are, and we shot that, but then they escorted everyone to the other stage. But it, when they reached the other stage, they had a little band and kind of like clowns and everything just to kind of get them fired up again.
That's so strange. And they could have just given them alcohol.
Yeah. You're always going to get people to laugh if you do that. You know, just do it secretly.
I feel like we skipped an entire era. Your Muppets era. There's no way that was after Tool time.
It was before Tool time and after.
Oh.
I was in association with them for some time when I, way back, I was working a local show at the ABC affiliate, WXYZ. In Detroit and getting paid, I think, in food stamps or something.
What show was it?
Yeah, Hot Fudge.
I remember that, yeah.
Hot Fudge,
yeah. That's right, yeah.
And it was, you know, it was like a great opportunity. And this Bob Elnick again, who was the creator of these puppets that we ran, and I did on camera things too, goofy things. They'd make me up and we'd do things. But it had, the first year, it had, Artie Johnson as the MC.
Okay.
Not MC, but the kind of host of the show. And then there were all these different puppets. And they had a lot of good guests. They had Sammy Davis Jr. and all these people that appeared at Pine Knob Theater, outside theater, and they would cajole them to do the Hot Fudge Show. So we worked puppets and so forth. and this guy said, you know, you really like Jim Henson's work. Would you like to meet him? And I said, sure. And he said, well, are you willing to go to New York and so forth? And I said, yeah. So he set it up, and I thought, wow, this is a phenomenal opportunity. I get to meet Jim Henson. And so I drew up some of the Sesame Street characters and colored them in and just worked like crazy. And then I flew into New York, and I got in my room, my hotel room, and which was not one of the better hotels. And I put everything out on the bed, all these drawings that I had framed and matted and so forth. And they suddenly looked horrible. They looked fine back home.
You're like, what am I doing?
Yeah. These are horrible. I can't show them this stuff. And so you can't believe this. I actually called over and I said, hello, Mr. Henson. It's kind of late. I wouldn't want to keep you there. So maybe I'll come in another time and we can get together. And he said, no. And he said, come on over. He said, I'm making a dollhouse for my daughter.
Wow.
And I thought, damn it. I have to meet you. So anyway, of course, it's raining cats and dogs. And I went out in the street and tried to catch a cab in New York and had this stupid little hat. And a Levi jacket, I think, at the time, because I had to hurry over there. I couldn't change much. And I finally got a cab, got there, knocked on the...
What year do you think this was?
74.
Okay, so this is like very beginning of the Muppets. If not,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, very beginning for me.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I... he buzzed me in, and I climbed these stairs up to the Muppet Creative Center where they made all the Muppets and everything. And there was Jim on the phone when I reached the top of the stairs, and he looked over at me. He almost did a double take because this time I'm soaking wet. I'm standing there with my portfolio just wanting to say, oh, really, you don't want to do this. And so I went in there, and he got off the phone, and we introduced each other, and he said, I understand you do voices and so forth. And I said, yeah, I do that. And he said, let's see what you have. And he took them out. Took out the drawings, and I kind of wincing, making them excuses, I'm sure, for why they didn't look as good as I
had. Every artist does that, yeah.
Well, there was a funeral there. And so he said, so you do puppetry, huh? He said, I'd like to see. And he picked up this practice Muppet. They're made out of just foam glued together, mm-hmm. and so forth. And he said, go ahead.
Oh, man.
I'm going, go ahead.
I would have a heart attack.
Yeah, well, believe me, I was close to it. And I think the adrenaline, I don't know quite what happened, but I made him laugh and then put it down. And he stopped for a minute and he said, how would you like to come here and work? And I went, wow, yeah. And I mean, it was an amazing offer. One that there are occasions where I go, why didn't I do that? It was a little piece of the pie, profit sharing thing, that type of thing. And he was very kind. So he offered me that, and I had to come to, I came to New York and went to Muppet School, Muppet University, which is kind of a little joke. Mm-hmm. But there was myself and Dave Golez, who became a Muppeteer. And we were both out of town. He was out of Oregon, I think. And so we went through all the real puppetry and the guts of puppetry, which, you know, everybody can put on a puppet on their hand and then just open the mouth and do silly things. But as they really stress, that when you do the puppet, you don't just go blah, blah, you know, and the mouth goes open and the eyes go back on a puppet, if you can imagine that. Mm-hmm. They say keep the head down always. When you're talking to someone, you don't go blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's eye contact. So you'll notice, you know, the Muppets on TV or any of the films they did or whatever, there's almost like a pushing of the character, but always the eye contact is right on. And so I went through it, but I was at the time, it was 2 weeks, as I remember, of really concentrated work. And at the time, I just didn't want to go to New York. I had met what would become my wife eventually. And I was kind of homesick. I was kind of tired of the concrete, you know, streets of New York. And so I actually turned them down at that point, but he asked if I wanted to come in and do other work. And I did one of the first character, how would you say, style books. And I would, he had me come in and I would sit with, they sit me down and there would be Ernie on a stand. And they didn't realize it, but when they'd leave, I'd go, damn, there's Ernie.
Yeah. I mean, as anyone would. Yeah.
Yeah. And then they'd bring in Bert and then they'd bring in Grover, who's one of my favorites. And, then it started to happen on Grover, particularly. I started drawing him, and Jim would come in and he'd go, oh, yeah, yeah, Grover, good, good, good. Oh, but could you, that eye doesn't quite look right. Maybe could you change that a little bit? And can you do this and come that? And then I'd say, oh, sure, sure. And he'd leave, and I'd erase and do it. And then Frank would come in, Frank Oz, and he'd say, oh, wow, that eye isn't right. And I go, oh, boy.
Oh, your parents were fighting.
It was terrible. It was terrible.
So was it at that time that you, correct me if I'm wrong, but you created Dr. Teeth, right?
Right.
So for our listeners, can you tell them that story and who exactly Dr. Teeth is? Because he's one of those characters that everyone knows and loves, but a lot of people don't know his name because they rarely say it.
Yeah, it's a very strange character, straight out. Luckily, I finally got credit for it in one of the books. I think it's called Imagination, The Muppets or something. Mm-hmm. Got it downstairs, but what I did is I was a big fan of Dr. John, the Night Tripper or whatever he was called, and you know he would do this New Orleans sound, and it just seemed so great, and I modeled this character after him. I called him the Boogeyman. Mm-hmm. When I got in the first drawings, of which I'm still looking for those. But they, I had pictured him because Dr. John at that time would do this whole kind of hoodoo type show where he'd throw glitter around and he'd come out in this big kimono type of thing and kind of undulate around the stage and then sit down and just bang that piano. And so I thought, yeah, that would be such a fun character. And so what I was imagining is having little hula hoops at various stages. Imagine from small to larger to smaller. In other words, like his stomach. And when he would walk out there, this whole thing would like undulate, like,
yeah,
jello. Yeah. You know, and so I thought, oh, that's really fun. And then, not thinking, I drew him with teeth.
Big teeth.
And yeah, big teeth. And I showed it to Jim, and Jim was the greatest. He was so down to earth. I sat in the waiting room, and Steve Martin was in there, and they were talking about something, and they went way, you know, past my time that I was supposed to be in there.
Like Steve Martin? Like the jerk?
Yeah, like the jerk, yeah.
Excuse me, so Steve, cool. I got to talk to Jim.
Hey, Steve, come on. Don't be a hog, okay? Pop in. You know, I should have done it. I make history. I was so naive. I can't believe I did. But I didn't get mad because I said, hell, it's Steve Martin. Yeah. But I'll tell you, he spent as much time with me as he did Steve after they, you know, they broke up. And so when I went in there, I pitched or I put the drawings out, and I said, you know, he's the boogeyman, and he's, you know, and he's that kind of fashioned after Dr. John, and it's that whole New Orleans sign, you know, type music. And I was in a band at the time. And oh boy, can't believe I even did this, but he liked the drawings, and he said, oh, but you know, the Muppets don't have teeth. And I said, well, I can get rid of those. I can get rid of those. And he said, no, you know, it's kind of interesting. Let's see if we can do that. And that's why he named him Dr. Teeth, because that was the first Muppet with teeth.
Now,
like that.
To explain to the listeners, too, yeah, he's in the Muppets. What was the Muppets band again called?
Mayhem.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he's and, the guy yeah, with the big teeth lead. And the gold tooth.
Yeah, big teeth, big kind of orangey nose, vermilion nose, and so forth. So he was all for it. He and Mike Frith changed some of the costuming later. The drawing that appears in the book is it's a later version that I did. And then they took it a little further because it's not the boogeyman, you know, with the hula hoop type thing. But here's the funny part about a kid from the Midwest. I said, wasn't a kid, but I said, you know, Jim, I said, you know, I play in a band and we play some of that kind of music.
Oh, man.
And, you know, suddenly, because he was so down to earth, you almost felt like you were, you know, talking to one of your friends on the block. Mm-hmm. And he looked up at me and said, I was thinking of getting Dr. John to do the music. I said, oh, yeah, right. You could do that. That would be a better move. Oh man, that one I still cringe when I think about that.
We all have those moments.
So, oh yeah, you gotta have a few.
And you, oh sorry, go on.
Yeah, no, that was the beginning of a lot of different characters that were created. I created a character for Sesame Street named Sam the Robot. Mm-hmm. He was this kind of character, big bow tie, and he was robotic. And there was a guy in there running this thing. It was on Sesame Street for a while, but the mechanics kept breaking down, so eventually it went away. But I designed a lot of monsters, and I had been doing these gum cards for a company. One of my first commercial jobs, and I had these characters, and I showed them to Jim, and he said, oh, wow, I need monster drawings. So I did a lot of those, too. And I think it was around the era of, what was his name? I can't even think of the puppet's name. But anyway, a lot of the little creatures and things were off of designs and so forth. It was just wonderful knowing him, and as you know, time went on, we were almost just like friends, you know, pals.
Yeah.
Well, a creative! He was going to take over Walt Disney.
I mean, that would have
he was going to be the next. They said that Michael Eisner, when Jim passed, I was at the church. In New York, St. Patrick's, I think, and Michael Eisner was in there, and as on the way out, I could hear him talking about the fact that, yeah, now maybe the kids can step up or something to that effect. But they thought he was that rare person that could fill the shoes of Walt Disney because of his imagination and so forth.
Yeah, and there really hasn't been one since, you know?
No. Nope. Nope. I'm afraid not. That's sad because...
I mean, it kind of feels like at that point they should have given Disney to you, right?
That's what I thought. That's what I thought. Oh, my God, at that funeral.
Oh, yeah. I couldn't imagine.
Got right. Big Bird did the eulogy. Oh, come on.
Wow. That's insane. Yeah. Just, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, people. And he didn't want it that way. He didn't want sadness. You were given, I think there were little butterflies on a rod, and you held those because he just didn't want anybody sad.
I believe it.
You know, he was just the best. And, you know, it's sad because he could have still been around today if he had gotten to the hospital early enough.
Which is
really bad. But I'll tell you, with my wife one time in New York, we went over to the set and so forth, and Frank Oz had Grover, which is my wife's favorite Muppet too, and he did 20 minutes of some of the things that will never be on TV, but were the funny. He had us on our knees laughing. He just devoured her, which was really, really neat. I wish I'd taken more pictures. But
how did one of the other things you worked on was Eureka's Castle, right? And that was that cartoon or was that puppets? It's been so
that was
long.
Puppets.
So did that come from Henson, or was that? How did you
get
into that?
The creator of that show, the producer of that show, head writer, was again R.L. Stein.
Okay.
Nobody knows that.
Yeah.
That he and Bob Stein or R.L. Stein is just so easy to work with. I skipped something because that was just prior to Home Improvement, and at least I got some writing skills from that. And Bob was such a help in saying, why don't we do this? And, you know, would you change that? But it was the best thing in the world. I could just sit in my little home studio and write out a premise. And then I worked with this other writer, Tex Ragsdale. And we would confer back and forth, write the script. We'd fax it over. And then like a week and a half later, we'd get a check. It was like, oh, please, God, make this go on forever. It was just too much to believe. And Bob is, like I say, very easy to work with. But, yeah, Eureka's Castle, I think he was a Muppeteer and then went out kind of on his own. And that's being reshown, by the way.
Really? Was that Nickelodeon? What was that?
It was Nick, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, they're the ones that produced that, and I forgot. I think it was two seasons, three. But a great learning experience and great fun because they're fun characters. You can, you know, really do a lot with the characters.
Yeah, I remember that show. I was a little bit too old, you know, for that show to be, you know, for me to be that audience. But I remember seeing parts of it and thinking like this is pretty special. It's really good.
Oh, that's great. Cause they announced it, I think last week that it was coming back to, where is that coming to? I got the announcement. I'm sorry. I don't have the information, but Bob Stein sent the, cast picture and the announcement and said it was going to reappear.
Whoever owns Nickelodeon will be on whatever streaming service that is.
Yeah, whatever that is.
HBO, Paramount, or whatever.
There's so many everythings. You know? I mean, right now there's so many networks my God, it's just, it's amazing. I mean, it's wonderful.
Yeah, because, it went from the golden era of TV to staring at the sun. There's just too much.
Yeah, it's exactly that. And that's why these award shows don't work anymore. Look at the ratings of the Emmys, the Oscars, Golden Globes, because no one's on the same page. So yeah, when they announce, the winner is, Blue Moon on Sunday, everybody sits there. Huh? Yeah. The heck is that?
I didn't pay for that network. I don't know.
So their ratings, I don't know. They may have had their day. It's just the entertainment scope is so large. Great for creative people, but as far as, only things like the Super Bowl or, some event that pulls people together onto the same page can make it today, really, as far as a huge audience. Yeah. When we were doing Home Improvement, Home Improvement was getting like 35 million people. You're not going to see that today in most of the ratings.
Yeah, now it's like 400,000 to 500,000, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's weird. Yeah.
YouTube will get more than that.
Yeah, yeah. YouTube's fabulous. I love YouTube.
Really is.
Really. I mean, to be able to just go, I would like to learn how to tattoo myself.
Anything.
And there's a guy that comes on going, ouch, ouch. Yeah. This is the way you do it. I mean, it's fantastic.
So, but we're running a bit long here, but I just wanted to get back to your book. You get back to your book. So, what's the title? Book. Where can people get it?
It's called "I Think He's Crazy," which is kind of me. So
yeah.
I think he's crazy. It's the comic strips of B.K. Taylor. You can get it from Fantagraphics. And I'm not sure it's still available, but from Fantagraphics, you actually can get one with a little sketch that I did. I sketched out a lot of insert cards and signed them and so forth. Because it's a little more expensive at Fantagraphics because you cannot compete with Amazon.
Yeah, it's on Amazon, but you get more buying from the other place.
You get this little, signed thing. That's the way Barnes & Noble and these places are trying to compete with Amazon because Amazon is so cheap. When I first saw it go on to Amazon, I called the publisher and I said, geez.
There's a mistake. It's not the press.
Oh my God, they're giving this thing away. And he said, I know. How do we? He said, it doesn't change your royalty or your, our position or anything else. But he said, I don't know how they do it. He said, it just, so that's why I kind of went to these autographed sketches of, most of them are.
Do you think it's called the Amazon because they just mowed down the Amazon forest in order to do the books themselves?
I think so. Come on, Rob. Let's tell it like it is.
Yeah. But then R.L. Stein does the foreword, right?
Tim Allen does the foreword. R.L. Stein does the backward, which not too many books have. And then the back, I've got Mike Judge, who was a fan of the Appletons, too.
A personal and hero of mine.
Yeah, he's phenomenally funny. And Al Jean from The Simpsons, he's one of the, he's the head producer of The Simpsons. And I think Maddie Simmons is in there and other very kind people that supported it. So I'm very lucky.
And I'm lucky you're on this podcast. And the book is I Think He's Crazy. And I think everyone should buy it. And thank you so much for spending time with me.
Well, thank you, Rob. Appreciate it. It was fun.
All right. Thank you, BK, so much for that interview. It was a very, very fun conversation. And that book, again, is I Think He's Crazy. And I guess we should go into Game Club, huh?
Yeah, we should do that.
Want to do yours first?
Yeah, so I did Rastan, which I have on a couple arcade collections. And I also I have the Master System version, which is a pretty good port. Mm-hmm. And so Rastan's a very kind of, I would call it 80s artwork-inspired game. You know, it looks like a lot of, you know, metal album cover art is what it looks like to me. Like, mm-hmm. like the graphics and the obviously the characters. And it's clearly very, very much inspired by, like, Conan the Barbarian. And it's a fairly advanced platforming game, I thought, for the arcade. I mean, it's a 60, it runs on hardware that's pretty close to the Sega Genesis. And it's a little, I mean, I'm hesitant to call it an adventure game. You know, it's really a fantasy-themed game, but you have, like, different paths you can take through the levels. Not a ton of differences, you know, like maybe there's like a cave that bypasses, you know, goes under part of the level or whatever. But there's different weapon upgrades and, you know, all these, like, you know, giant monsters out of fantasy settings. The arcade version, though, is really, really hard. So this was clearly meant to be a game that, you know, you were going to spend $5 or $6 to get through an entire playthrough.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's a lot of cheap deaths, whether it's falling or just the game will throw like 20 enemies at you. Maybe not 20, literally, but you know what I'm saying? Like a lot of enemies at you all at once.
If you touch water, instant death.
Mm-hmm. Instant, yeah. Right, right. It's the same problem as going back to Vice City. Same problem that game has, right? Your player in Vice City can like crash a car at 80 miles an hour or like jump off the side of a building and usually survive. But if you touch water, you die.
Yes.
And Rastan has the exact same problem. And then the Master System version is, of course, a little bit scaled down, but it's kind of easier, you know, because they're not trying to just drain you of all your quarters. I think it's a pretty good conversion. I was really surprised there wasn't a Sega Genesis conversion. I mean, I get like this was a like 88-ish arcade release, so maybe by the time the Genesis came out, they thought it would be too old. I don't know. It's a much better arcade game than like Altered Beast, which was on the Genesis, though. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, the best way to get this, it's on the like title collections. You know, title legends, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Is a good way to get this. So did you play Rastan?
Yeah, and I actually did the Apple II GS version, mm-hmm. and we talk about that system way too much, but that is a great port. It looks good, sounds good, so. But I think in terms, I quickly tried out in emulation the Master System port, and mm-hmm. very good as well. There are a lot of bad ports of this game, too. But those two, mm-hmm. I think, you're pretty solid with. But it kind of reminded me of Legendary Axe. I don't know which one I like better. They both have their issues.
Legendary Axe plays kind of faster.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and I think Rastan has a better hitbox, too. I don't mm-hmm. know. Yeah, I probably like Rastan a little bit better. But yeah. Any final thoughts on that one?
No. I mean, like, overall, it's a very nostalgic game for me. So I remember, like, first time I saw it in the arcade, just being blown away by the graphics.
Do you remember what arcade that was?
It was Aladdin's Castle.
Those were everywhere, weren't they?
Yeah. There was definitely an Aladdin's Castle. There were a couple that I toggled between. It was definitely Aladdin's Castle. At that point, like, I mean, I wasn't going to, like, roller rinks and stuff, you know, or other places where arcade games might be found.
I guess I'll do mine. So, geez, another Apple II GS game. I guess it's on other systems as well. Task, Times, and Toontown for Burger Becky. So, yeah, this was on Apple II, Apple II GS, Amiga, Commodore 64, Macintosh, PC, and Atari ST. And, this is a strange but fun game. Like I said in that interview, this was probably my first favorite game. The graphics just blew me away. The story I thought was just fantastic. And so it's from 1986 and it feels very 80s. And and someone, your grandfather, Gramps, goes missing, and you go into his lab and go through this portal into, I guess, the future. I don't know. I guess it's like an alternate reality slash future. And everyone is very new wave and punk. It's like if the 80s just kept going in that direction. Of course, right. Like in all those future stuff from the late 80s, somehow payphones are still a thing, except this one hovers instead of having video. So no video, but it hovers. Guitar picks are the currency, which are still better than Dogecoin, in my opinion.
I agree, yeah.
But it's a text adventure that also has graphics. So you could call it a graphical adventure, but you could seriously turn off the graphics in this and just go by the description. Like underneath the graphics, it describes everything. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with your mouse, you could click north, south, east, or west and a few, you know, grab, listen, drop type buttons. Or you could type that stuff as well. This was a little bit difficult for me as a kid because it is pretty picky for what you type. So, you know, like let's say there's one of those big like Frankenstein switches on the wall. You have to say throw switch instead of like flip switch or something like that. And I didn't, you know terms like that when I was young. But TAS kind of means cool. You know, in this reality. But you could probably beat this game in half an hour. You know, just use a game fact, I would say. And I would definitely say it's worth it. It's a product of its time. It's crazy that this fit on like an 800 kilobyte floppy. Did you get a chance to look at this one at all?
So I was going to say, you can beat it in about half an hour. It's 38 minutes because while having lunch one day, I watched a playthrough of the game.
Nice.
I figured I wasn't going to have time to like learn, you know, the syntax of this text adventure and solve the puzzles. Like I would get 15 minutes in, not make it out of the first room and decide I didn't have time for it. So I just watched a 38-minute playthrough of it while having a sandwich, which isn't actually, you know, better than like reading the news at lunch.
It's actually a pretty good lunch, yeah.
Yeah. And it was pretty cool. I did like, it does seem like it started as a complete text adventure game because you probably notice this when the graphics are loading. Sometimes you'll see that the text like covers the whole screen.
Yeah.
So like on the screen, you only have like a little text box, but it's actually drawing it like all the way up. Mm-hmm. So there's like multiple layers there. I'm not familiar with the 2GS hardware, so I don't know like how many graphical planes it has. But
the 2GS is a Super Nintendo.
Okay. That's easy to understand then.
Yeah.
And yeah, the graphics were really cool. I mean, they were definitely very 80s inspired. And I mean, even with watching it from start to finish, I couldn't really tell you what the plot of the game was. It was really weird. You know, the characters look like, you know, sort of, hot pink versions of Demolition Man characters, but at the same time, there's also like talking animals. So, and nobody questions that. I think you mentioned that. It's just a very strange game. I think I definitely would have liked it back in the day.
One thing that I thought was funny, though, is that your grandpa's dog, Spot, actually jumps through the hoop to go into this alternate future reality with you.
Yeah.
And when he gets there, you realize that his name there is Ennio the Legend, and he's totally sentient. He's really popular there. So that was really funny. But yeah, I would definitely give this one a thumbs up. I'd give it a go. And yeah, if you're not going to load an emulator for this one, because you're not going to find one that works probably. Yeah. Or, you know, you're not going to find an actual disc that works. Just use an emulator. I think watching a video of this would be fine. It sounds like a great lunch.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not the first or last time that I've watched like a 30-minute playthrough of something instead of deciding not to watch the news.
Yeah. So what are you going to play next?
I am going to play Total Carnage. I think we did Smash TV a while ago. Total Carnage is sort of a sequel to it, and this game I'm playing, Shakedown Hawaii, reminds me a lot of Total Carnage. They're completely different genres, but the artwork and like the style of humor and the way the combat works are clearly inspired by Total Carnage.
Cool. Cool. I'm excited for that one. I'm going to do Pigs in Space on the 2600. Just, right. I had to come up with a BK Taylor tie-in to video games. And so there's your Muppets tie-in.
Yeah, because you don't want to play the Home Improvement video game.
Or the Eureka's Castle video game is for preschoolers, so probably not that either.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the only Muppets game I've ever really liked is Muppets Party Cruise.
Let's do this. Let's do any Muppets game.
Okay.
Any Muppets game.
I know there's a Game Boy Advance Muppets game that I've heard is okay, but I haven't played it.
I think there's, isn't there like Miss Piggy's Wedding or something?
There. Yeah, I think like it seems like something that maybe the No Swear Gamer did a review of a long time ago. I'm trying to remember now where I first heard about Miss Piggy's Wedding. I think that's meant to be a game for, I think it's also meant to be a game for preschoolers though.
Nice. Nice. So if any of our listeners play any of those games or have any comments about the interview or I would say news items, but none this week, please email us. Email at retrogameclub.net. That is email at retrogameclub.net. Facebook, facebook.retrogameclub.net, or at RGC Podcast on Twitter. Zach handles all that stuff. And feel free to send in your questions for the Ask Us Anything episode 100 as well. And you feel like taking some emails?
Yeah. I'll get the first one here from Majors talking about convention hesitance. And yeah, he said it's really bad because, you know, he and many others, like a lot of their income is based on conventions. Like, you know, that's how they make their living. So we need to find ways to get people to go out to them anyways. And yeah, again, like I'm not worried about, me personally, I'm not worried about catching COVID at this point. I'm more worried about getting like the flu because I haven't had it in 12 months. although I will presumably get a flu shot before November, whenever Midwest Gaming Classic is. But, you know, that's mostly it. My grievance was I haven't been sick for like 14 months now. And that seems like a pretty good streak.
And it's awesome, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Or you get like the stomach flu, you know, someone, that's the worst.
Yeah.
but yeah, so I'm going to end up going to Midwest Gaming Classic. I'm just not sure, like, if I'm going to wear the Sub-Zero mask or just accept the fact that I will probably end up catching at least a cold. I've got a PS5, so there goes one drinking game. All right. He was glad to hear about the pencil trick for Dragon Field because he remembers it in the arcade. And he mentions in the DS release of Konami Classic Arcade Hits, there is Track and Field. In the options menu, it enables turbo buttons.
Hmm.
So you don't have to worry about breaking your DS. You can just have automatic turbo fire, which is cool. Very sad news about Sega getting out of the North American arcade business. But, of course, North American operators can still buy or import Sega games. And similar to Namco selling off their locations around the same time. I guess they must have done that a few months ago. What else here? Playing PS1 games on PS2. He says, no issue with the using the PS2 to get your PS1 fix, but he has yet to figure out how to play, let's say, homebrew or home-burnt games. You know, games you burned yourself on the PS2, which is true, you probably cannot. PS1 remote reset, just talking about other systems that have a remote reset, like the Saturn, if you can somehow press A, B, C, and start at the same time. And of course, everyone knows about the TurboGrafx one, where if you press, you know, select and run at the same time, it resets. By the way, I hate that.
I've done it on an accident at the wrong times.
Yeah, absolutely wish they did not do that. I don't know why you would ever want that, really. It also makes it too easy to, like, rage quit a game.
And also, PC Engines had, like, a 3-foot cord. Like, you were within arm's length already.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah, I've definitely lost games because I played a lot of like RPGs on there, and there are definitely times that I accidentally lost some progress from, you know, trying to open up the menu or whatever and mess myself up. Roller Rink Arcade Memories. He wants to give a shout out to Yair Kung Fu in Kajiki, which I mispronounced. And also, he mentioned the skating rink game rooms he went to were always at least one full year behind the arcades. Uh-huh. So they had lots of things with busted controls. It's a comparison of DDR game pads, but I can't speak intelligently about DDR pads, even through someone else's words. As for Game Club games, he's a big fan of Time Pilot, and it's on that same Konami Classics that has Track and Field. So that sounds like a good collection.
Yeah.
And then he mentions having a converted Qbert cabinet that has a version of it on like a 60-in-1 cartridge. And then ports better than the arcade. He prefers some of the Namco fighters, like Soul Calibur on the Dreamcast, because it has a quest mode, or Tekken 3 on the PS1 because of all the mini games.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Very cool. Also, I like Crazy Taxi better on the Dreamcast than arcade because it has mini games.
Yeah, yeah. And thank you, Majors, for that email. Yeah. Lou writes in, I think, a first-time writer-inner. I asked, Lou isn't saying this, but I asked about Neo Geo memory card experiences in the arcade, and he actually did this in a local laundromat. They had Magician Lord, and so he got a memory card so he could try to advance in the game, and it just didn't work. Someone, you know, tampered with the memory card slot, and it just wasn't a great experience. And, you know, I could definitely see that happening because I had a Neo Geo cab for a while, and obviously I didn't let the public play my cab, and it was still hard to maintain. So, yeah. People will kind of go out of their way to break anything.
Wait, do you think someone tried to cram a quarter in the memory card slot?
100%.
Something like that?
100%.
Yeah, I'm looking at a picture. It's been a long time since I've seen at least a year since I've seen a Neo Geo. Yeah, I could see someone actually trying to cram a dollar in that.
And, I mean, I've seen, you know how they have those trivia little video game machines at bars, like the little bar top things?
Uh-huh.
I've seen people just like shove napkins into them. I've seen people do horrible things for no reason. So I'm not surprised. But it could have been, yeah, just someone was confused and put a corner or did something in there. Yeah.
Yeah. Tried to put their laundry in the thing. I don't know.
It may have just been not connected too. They're easy. If you're working on the board, it's an easy thing to forget to reconnect. Yeah, but someone put some detergent in it.
Yeah, they tried using the Neo Geo like a laundry machine. He said it's a laundromat.
And we got some social media questions from Zach. What arcade games have you actually used memory card or password in? Someone writes in, what you said, Hugh, NFL Blitz 99. And he thought there was a way in NBA Jam, but I don't think there was. Was there?
Maybe not original NBA Jam. Was there a later...
Tournament edition, right? Or was that just
the tournament edition was no, that was in the arcade. And I don't remember that having a memory card. You could enter your initials, but that was just your initials. So I guess anybody could do that. Was there later versions of NBA Jam maybe? Because I didn't really follow the series much after 94.
No, I can't remember. I don't think so.
Yeah. We might not know what we're talking about here either, though.
Yes. I mean, this is the podcast of no research.
None. Yeah. at least one listener really likes the Master System port of Rastan. So that's good. We got some love for that.
Someone else not playing PS1 games on a PS1.
Okay. Good. I almost never do either. we had some Street Fighter the Movie talk. Street Fighter the Movie the arcade game talk. After last episode, someone reminded us that you can blow up the people in the audience, including me, with... a code. Left punch, medium punch, medium kick, high blah, 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 and so on. I did not know about that. Like it was never mentioned. I think it was added late. I think it's hilarious. So I found out about it like it was either like GamePro or EGM or maybe Die Hard Game Fan. Like one of those had the code. It was like the only code I ever saw for the game. In any magazine. So, I don't think they had the move list. They just had that.
That's awesome. Yeah, and someone thanks you for, or French Brett, French Pet thanks you for raising the Street Fighter, the movie, the video game prices on eBay.
Yeah. Yeah, except I'm not in those versions. So those you're are like different backgrounds. The Home Cup versions have different backgrounds.
You're like the Elon Musk of Street Fighter, the movie, the game.
I don't know what that means.
You could raise and lower the price. I don't know.
Oh, I see. Of the arcade version only, though, is yes. the problem. Yeah, the home versions, they, as I understand it, they used the same, they used all the digitized actors that were made for the arcade version. So they took all those files and imported them. But then they used different backgrounds. I don't know why. Most of the backgrounds in the arcade version were animated in some way, and maybe that was a, for all I know, it's like, oh, we can't do that on the Saturn. You know, I have no idea what, you know. It's not that you can't do it on the Saturn. It's we can't figure out how to do this on the Saturn. So it might have been something as simple as that. But I understand they kept the characters. They may or may not have kept the special moves the same. They might have tweaked the mechanics to feel more like Street Fighter II. But yeah, it's you know, 50% the same game.
Did you just not license your likeness for home ports?
Yeah, that, like that's exactly it. For the no dollars that I was I was paid for this. Yeah, no, it was something like that. Yeah, where they couldn't get the animated backgrounds working. I think what the story was. Or maybe they didn't like the backgrounds. Maybe they wanted to do ones that looked more like. See, I've never played the home version, so I don't know if the backgrounds look more like Street Fighter 2. You know, if they're still digital backgrounds, but I'm wondering if they shot ones that look like the backgrounds from Street Fighter 2 rather than use the new locations.
Yeah, I'm going to have to fire that up. I just can't remember. It's probably been 3 or 4 years since I've played one.
Yeah, a lot of people bought those home versions because they were essentially launch titles. They weren't actually launch titles, I don't believe, but they were really, really early releases. And like early on the Saturn didn't have very many games. Mm-hmm. So it's like, oh, Street Fighter the movie? Why not?
It's like, I guess. French Pet writes in again about the Birgit Becki interview. He was also a Ranma one-half fan, and he's really interested in reading her fan fiction. And he just talks about how it was really difficult to get anime back in like 96. And even some, you know, manga as well. And I would agree. I'm sure it was, but I was really lucky to grow up. I was really into it back in 96 as well, but I grew up between a media play. Did you guys have those in Chicago? Media play?
Media play? No. So we had,
it was like Suncoast, but Best Buy size.
Yeah, I was like, obviously Aladdin's Castle and, Namco Game Station. I think it was called.
Oh, no, this is just video stores.
Oh, videos. This is a video store. I'm sorry.
VHS
this is the
store.
Entirely.
And so I grew up between one of those and a really good comic store called Time Travelers that sold a lot of anime. So I actually was pretty broke because I was spending all my money on that stuff. But I agree. The kids have it too easy now. And, oh, yeah, we were talking about custom controller or customizing controller buttons, something like that, right?
Yeah, about the game where you do nothing but customize the controllers.
Yes, that's right. So, I don't know the game Steel Battalion. Was that, you said it was on the original Xbox. I don't know that game.
Yeah, it was original Xbox, and it came with a giant controller, which I think is what the picture is here. I remember it had like you couldn't just buy the game. You had to buy it in a box the size of your car with a controller.
That's amazing. I didn't scroll down far enough to see this. Wow, this is awesome. It's like a flight stick and so much more. Wow. I kind of want this now.
Yeah. It was a really... I don't know if I've seen one in person, but I knew of this game. Again, because I don't have an Xbox, right? So,
I want to take this controller and build like a BattleTech center with it.
Yeah,
we had build around
too.
It.
Did you have a BattleTech center in your area?
Not for a long time. You know, I think it was only there for a year or two. I think there's still one between us in Kalamazoo, if I remember right.
Okay.
That would be a great episode because there's a whole scene of what a tangent this is. There's a whole Raspberry Pi scene of just creating BattleTech centers out of those. So you could either use like the hacked code or people are doing homebrew stuff. I think that's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, because those BattleTech machines are probably significantly less powerful than a Raspberry Pi at this point.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, they are so powerful for the time, but they are probably like 40 megahertz.
Yeah. But yeah, Steel Battalion, this was this has got to be a collectible item. I don't know if you can like map these controllers to like other games. But yeah, it was a very advanced controller. It's got like three pedals, two joysticks. You could definitely use this for a flight sim, racing game, whatever. I mean, it's very advanced.
Yeah, like X-Wing or something like that. That would be awesome.
Yeah.
Well, cool. That is all the feedback. And we still got this episode pretty long. Pretty good.
Yeah. Yep. Well, you can cut half of it if you want.
Okay, we'll see.
We'll see. All right. Sorry about that. All right. All right, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, thank you. Ooh.